It's not easy being green, and not just for banjo-picking frogs. Some researchers have found plants have feelings, too. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our gardening show, we're going to discuss what plant intelligence means and ask our gardening experts what they think. We'll also talk about what to plant in your garden when, and of course, we'll take your questions. Joining me now are Ohio State University Extension Educator Carrie Brown. Thanks for being here, Carrie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kenton County Extension Office Horticulture Extension Agent Brandon George. Welcome back, Brandon.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator Kamisha Montgomery. Thanks for being here, Kamisha.
Hello. Thank you.
First, do you think your plants are plotting against you? Do they understand you? Or do you have other gardening questions for our experts? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Now, I need to ask all of you just to fess up, do you sing or talk to your plants? Brandon, I'm going to ask you first because you're looking at me like, don't ask me this question.
I don't know. I don't for sure, but I absolutely feel like on some level they respond to care and maybe happy feelings in a way around them. I don't know. I can't quantitatively say that, but I do think there's like good vibes you can give.
Okay. What do you think, Kamisha?
I agree with the vibes. just giving them good vibes and a good growing place to thrive is very, very important, I think. I don't necessarily sing, or I do sort of have small, short conversations with them.
Like what? What do you talk to them about?
Oh, nothing specific. Just random things. I do say hello when I walk in the room, you mm-hmm. know, and just make sure their soil is looking good and, you know, moving them around in the room sometimes. I have a different room where I might put one in there. Oh, they're in quarantine. Or they're taking a little time for therapy just to get a little bit more sun exposure and stuff like that.
Yeah, some light therapy.
Yeah.
What about you, Carrie? Do you sing or talk to your plants?
You know, I do. It's mostly apologizing. I'm not a very good houseplant mom. But I feel like I do that mostly to benefit myself. I mean, I'm aware that they're not aware of my voice. But, you know, that being said, I think this topic of plant intelligence is really interesting. It seems to kind of pop up every few years, like such as this article from The Atlantic. Then it's the topic of conversation again.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that article from The Atlantic. What do you think? Do you think that it makes a difference? I mean, there are scientists who've been studying these theories of plant intelligence. There's also this new book out called The Light Eaters that makes a case for this. Carrie, what do you make of these, you know, this research that's going on around plant intelligence?
Yeah. So I think it's fantastic, first of all, just because plant blindness is a real thing. You know, plants a lot of time, you know, aren't recognized in the same way that that animals are. And, you know, that word intelligence is a loaded term because there really is not one definition for intelligence. There's it's been much debated, you know, even amongst humans, what intelligent means. So when we apply that to something that is so biologically different than human, it's tough. I know over the winter, we do a book club with our Master Gardener volunteers. And in March, we read a book called What a Plant Knows. And it applied some of the human senses to what a plant experiences. And I know that the author kind of makes the argument that really the question should not be whether or not plants are intelligent, but are plants aware of their surroundings? And in that case, the answer is yes, because they are responding to their surroundings.
Yeah. Well, and the food writer Michael Pollan wrote about the relationship between plants and humans and the botany of desire and talked about how crops have taken advantage of humanity to thrive. Do you think plants are finding ways to entice us into helping them multiply, like corn? I mean, my husband refers to corn as our corn overlords, like corn's going to take over. Brandon, what do you think about that?
Oh, yeah. First of all, that book is fantastic. Secondly, I think it's more of how certain plants have evolved, not necessarily, I would say, to attract humans, but they got lucky enough that they were attractive to humans. And so we started cultivating them for our purposes. And I think he focuses on things like marijuana and apples and things, and how we have completely taken wild plants and kind of made them into what we need them for. And so by that sense, they are surviving and thriving because of our interest in them. So some plants have been lucky in that regard.
Yeah. Kamisha, what do you think? Are there some plants that are better at getting our attention than others?
Well, I think, like Brandon touched on, just the cultivation of different plants and different crops, especially like creating hybrid plants to meet our needs and what we feel is a satisfactory crop. And also it goes into, you know, not only just aesthetic looks and smell of certain plants or crops, but also disease resistance and things like that. So I think that plays a very big major part also in that.
Carrie, what do you think? Are there particular plants that entice us into helping them multiply?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's an intentional enticement, but it's, you know, it's kind of a, I think there's different plants that we've kind of formed a relationship with, or that as Brandon, is it?
Yes.
Brandon? Okay,
yes.
Okay, I apologize. As Brandon said that, you know, genetically, they kind of got lucky. For instance, like all of our brassicas, so broccoli, cabbage, kale, all of those are the same species. But their genes are, I guess, kind of flexible enough that it's allowed us to manipulate it in different ways, growing in different environments. And because of that, it's a very useful plant.
Hmm. And Carrie, plants can entice animals too. What are some of the ways they encourage pollination? It sounds like they can even trick animals sometimes.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, our flowering plants, our angiosperms, have been hugely successful. I believe there's like 800,000 species of flowering plants and 3,000 species of conifers that are not flowering. So it's, you know, within nature, that is a technique that's worked really well. And that's because of that symbiotic relationship with those pollinators. So, you know, that's why our flowers are beautiful. That's why they have the petals. That's why they have that fragrance, you know, produce those nectar rewards in order to attract the pollinators, in order to, you know, making it's just an easier way to make sure that their pollen is getting where it needs to go, rather than relying on something like the wind.
We're talking about gardening for the full hour today, and we have experts here to answer your questions. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We did get an email from Michelle. Michelle wrote, "Last year, chipmunks destroyed my cherry tomatoes. What can I do to stop them?" Is there any hope keeping chipmunks out of something like that, Kamisha?
Well, I would suggest just trying to create some kind of barrier around those plants. You can use like chicken wire to just sort of create a structure. Because four-legged pests can be very creative and ambitious, and you know, just like we are watching our cherries or our fruit and vegetables become ripened, they are also. So we have to be a little bit more vigilant in planning and scheduling our time to harvest. But creating a structure around that, I think, is a good way to prevent some of those pests from harvesting before we do.
Yeah. Brandon, do you have any kind of little critters in your garden that are especially fond of the stuff you plant?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like sometimes more, they're not intentionally trying to kill the plant, but I feel like sometimes the digging itself damages the plant. So like squirrels digging in all the time. And I think I have more of that issue, but unfortunately not really with chipmunks.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the kind of intelligence, if I dare use that word, of plants. They can put up these defense mechanisms, too. What are some of the ways they can combat caterpillars and other predators? Brandon, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah. So there's been a lot of research by Suzanne Simard and some others that have discussed how plants defend themselves and also how they communicate with one another, which is famously talked about, but they can send chemicals via the root systems to each other and pheromones that will signal to other plants of the same species that there's an attack. So they'll all kind of put out these chemicals that will therefore be put through the plants and leaves, and therefore the caterpillars or whatever's eating on them will no longer like the taste, or it will be poisonous. So plants absolutely can defend themselves. They're reactive, very much so. Mm-hmm. And they're adapted to certain, obviously certain pests more than others. They can adapt to defend themselves quicker.
Yeah. Well, again, we're talking about gardening for the whole hour today. We have people here who can answer your questions about your trees and shrubs and plants and vegetables and fruit, all the good things. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is something that came up on our last gardening show about using rock and roll music to keep deer away. One of our callers said that he did that and it was very effective. There was a book published in the 70s, The Secret Life of Plants, with a chapter that suggested plants could hear that they liked Beethoven more than rock and roll. I know there's been a lot of controversy over whether that's true, but if people are using loud music to keep deer away, is that having any kind of impact on the gardens themselves? Carrie, do you have thoughts on that?
I don't know about that. I mean, I could see how it could work for a short time for deer. It seems with deer, you have to kind of, you know, cycle through and switch it up every couple of weeks. You know, the reintroduction of rock and roll, I don't know, every couple months might work. I don't know about it having much of an effect on the plants, though.
Yeah. Are there different tones that can encourage growth that that plants respond to more than others, Carrie?
Not that I know of. I guess the only thing I can think of along those lines is, you know, our tomato plants and I believe our pepper plants, those flowers, when they are pollinated by bumblebees, those bees actually buzz at a certain frequency in order to prompt those flowers to release their pollen, I think, which is interesting.
Okay.
Buzz pollination is what it's referred to as.
Oh, that makes sense. We do have another email. This is an email from Greg. Greg writes, I'm setting up a container garden with fruits and vegetables on my deck, which is 20 by 20, full sun. I've grown watermelon seedlings, specifically the sugar baby type, and I still only have the two leaves from the seedling since March. I have them in the garage during cold nights. Hasn't been super cold lately, but I put them out in the sun on weekends. Is there any way to get these off to a great start? I've also started carrots from seedlings and had no luck getting them to germinate. I have put a board over them and kept them moist and checked them every day. Any advice on that? Kamisha, do you have any advice on this?
Well, I would try to have them out with longer exposures to sun than just the weekends. Just giving them that much more care, I think, would help get those seeds to germinate. Different seeds germinate at different temperatures. So I think exposing them to more heat will be good, especially for the sugar babies, definitely. That's a warm weather crop that's going to really thrive more with that heat. But also you'll want to check, since you're doing container gardening, check out the soil that you're using, because you're creating the atmosphere, or you're trying to mimic the atmosphere in which this plant is going to thrive in. So making sure that you have the correct soil composition is also key. And another thing is to make sure that you have the correct pot, as far as like the depth of the pot and things like that, and making sure that you're watering adequately. It's going to take a lot more effort in watering than an in-ground growing method, since you're using containers. And again, back to the container, depending on what material the container is how much water is going to be absorbed and things like that. So I would look more into some of maybe the sun exposure, the material of the container, and also the depth of the container.
Okay. We have a caller on the line. Hi, Ken. Thanks for calling. What is your question or comment?
Oh, thank you. I am kind of an avid gardener, and I have a fern garden where I've had several of my ostrich ferns come back, and they're just thriving. Yet one is just seems to be dead as a doornail, and I don't know whether to just continue waiting for it to come back, or is it too late? Here we are, mid-May. Mm. And also, the caller about the chipmunk problem, and word of advice is you need a snake. He will eat the chipmunks. Trust me.
So did you, I don't want to ask too many questions about the snake. Are you just turning a snake loose in your garden to take care of your chipmunk?
No, it's just, okay. I live adjacent to a park in woodsy area, and, you know, they're just around.
Okay, that's just nature. Okay,
yes,
great.
Yes.
Well, great. Let's see what we think about this ostrich fern. Brandon, do you have thoughts on how to tell if it's dead or just a little dead?
Yeah, I mean, I have some ostrich ferns, and I can tell you one or two in my garden this year didn't come back, and I do know that, you know, if you look at the crown towards the very center, if you don't see anything green, it probably has died off. But a lot of times, too, they will send out side shoots, and so you might get a few that way. So, you know, the hope isn't lost. But if you're really in doubt, dig up the plant, look at the roots, see if there's anything going on, and then you'll know for sure if it's still alive or not. But, they do go dormant, but it still might be alive. Maybe just check the roots.
Will that hurt the plant to check the roots?
No, because then you could, if it is truly alive, you could replant it. And if it is dead, then you could compost it.
Okay. Well, Ken, I hope that helps. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Uh-huh.
Bye-bye. We got a call from Brenda. Brenda says her hollyhock has yellowish bugs on the underside of the leaf. Any advice on what to do about that? Carrie, have you run into yellowish bugs on hollyhock?
I have not. I'm not exactly sure what that would be. I guess aphids are always one of the first things that come to my mind. There's an aphid for every plant out there. And oftentimes you do see those on the undersides of leaves. But if she's able to, get a good photo of it or bring a sample into her extension office, then they can assist with identification.
Did you have other thoughts, Brandon?
I was just going to say, too, make sure it isn't rust. They get these like golden rust stains all over the leaves and undersides especially, and that's really what devastates hollyhocks in our area. So the rust is a really big problem.
What can you do about rust?
You could spray fungicides, but it's so difficult with how much rain we get. It happens a lot with soil splashing. So look for the most resistant rust cultivars. That's probably the best bet too.
Okay. We have another caller on the line. Hi, Diane. Thank you for your call. What did you want to talk about?
Well, I've almost given up on broccoli, cabbage, and cauliflower. Other gardeners have said that they have given up on those. It seems like it gets like a fungus. It's a black kind of fungus. And I am not a super gardener, so I just like it to grow, and I'm willing to put on the oil and everything else. Can you tell me what to do about that?
Great question. I know you're a fan of the brassicas. Kamisha, tell us what's your advice?
First, if it's a fungus, I would think about your spacing, just trying to make sure that you're getting some good air circulation between those plants. But as far as like you might want to try a different fungicide, or you said you tried the oils like neem oil, try that out. But those are the major, I would say, things that you'll want to try to get rid of some of the fungus.
I hope that helps, Diane.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. I love your show.
Thanks for calling. We appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break, and we will continue with our gardening show in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today, and our experts are ready to answer your questions. My guests are Ohio State University Extension Educator Carrie Brown, Kenton County Extension Office Horticulture Extension Agent Brandon George, and Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator Kamisha Montgomery. If you have questions for them, and we know you do, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We did get an email from Gloria. We were talking about plant intelligence, and Gloria emails, plants are sentient beings. They do respond to humans. They respond to positivity. Personally, I always used to be able to have plants in my home. Last year, I bought many new plants, and the majority of them died. I've been very disappointed in this. However, I think it may have to do with the fact of my mood and what I've been going through. They do respond to prayer and positivity, so they probably respond to negativity. There have been studies done on this. Carrie, what studies have you seen about plants and the way they respond to, you know, positive or negative environments?
I think that I'm not sure exactly. I think that, you know, in a positive environment, if that is reflected in the care that they're receiving, the amount of attention they're receiving, then that, you know, is going to be beneficial for the health of the plant.
Mm-hmm. I guess it kind of gets back to that vibes point that we were talking about earlier, huh? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, we have an email from Frederica, and Frederica emails, I have peonies in my backyard, which always turn black and never flower. What should I do? From Frederica. Brandon, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I guess I'd want to know, is it the plant, the flowers, is it something's causing some kind of rot? But I was just trying to think what particularly it could be. If they're getting enough light, if they're getting enough air circulation, what would cause that dying off and they never getting flowers?
Could overwatering or too much moisture be a problem?
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on that, Carrie?
I guess I would need more photos.
Yeah,
I guess I
would photos. Photos would have been helpful. Carrie, you have any thoughts on peony problems?
Yeah, I agree. Just more information as of the site that they're growing in and the, you know, the type of issues they're actually having.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. We have Robert on the line. Hi, Robert. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hello, this is a question about sunflowers, the type that grow to 5 feet. I planted seeds in little peat pots back in March. I got nice settings, and they were about an inch tall. The 1st of May, when it turned warm and the calendar said it was okay, I put them out in the ground, in the peat, didn't take them out of the peat pot. They all died. Aww. Why would they all die? And is it too much water? Why would they all die? Was it rainy? Too wet?
Hmm. That's a bummer. Okay, thanks for that question, Robert. Do you have any thoughts, Kamisha, on what might have happened there?
Well, I was listening to his process, and it sounded like he may have missed a step as far as like hardening them off first to get them more acclimated to elements. So hardening them off is from the outs, from under the lights, or growing them indoors and bringing them off periodically to get them used to, you know, the wind, the sun exposure. So I think that is a step that might have been missed, and could have ultimately made them have the experience that he had.
Gotcha. Kind of like training wheels. You need to ease them into it.
Definitely.
Robert, does that sound like maybe a step that you missed?
Well, I never heard of that, and I was surprised. I appreciate knowing that, and I'll try again next year.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. We appreciate it. We have another caller on the line. Hi, Jerry. What are you calling about?
Hi, I'm calling about a hydrangea tree that we planted in the spring of 23. I live in a condo, but we have a small area outside of our home that we're allowed to plant in. It bloomed beautifully last year, but we were away for the winter, and unfortunately, apparently in early January, the landscapers came around and cut the tree's limbs all back. And now what's happened is I have a tree that's all leaves but no hydrangea flowers.
Mm.
And I'm wondering if there's any way to turn that around this season, or what I can do to make sure that next season, aside from preventing the landscapers from coming around, I can do to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Thank you. Carrie, do you have thoughts for Jerry?
Yeah, so without knowing the specific type of hydrangea you have, I can't give you an exact answer, because hydrangeas require pruning at different times of the year, depending on if they bloom on old wood or new wood. I know that a popular variety around here is limelight hydrangea, and it kind of does grow into a shrubby tree. It can get quite large. And the best time to prune that back is when the landscapers actually did it, so late winter. whether it's going to bloom this year, I don't know that there's anything that you can do to encourage it to bloom this year. The fact that it's leafing out heavily is good. That's, you know, that's what it needs to do right now, is to get those leaves and photosynthesize. And if you don't see those blooms this year, then I would expect them next year. They usually come back pretty quickly. That growth is pretty quick. In terms of making sure it doesn't happen again, I don't know if you have the ability to communicate with that landscape company, or perhaps put up some kind of signage, you know, before you leave for the winter. Those are my thoughts.
Yeah, Jerry, do you have any more specifics about your hydrangea?
I do. I guess I wasn't clear. This is not a hydrangea bush, but it's a hydrangea. I'll call it a tree. It was hydrangea that was grafted onto a large stem, so that it grows looking like a tree always, not that it's like out of shape and, you know, grown all over the place and now looks like a tree. It, you know, supposed to be this kind of slender trunk. It's the same kind of thing that you see with rose trees. It's that type of thing. And so it, just to clarify, it wasn't a bush at all. It was this grafted tree.
Okay.
So I don't know if that makes a difference or not.
Yeah, good to know. Does that make a difference in your eyes, Carrie? Or Brandon, do you want to add anything?
It sounds like it's the standard form, which technically it's still a shrub. And it's just a standard form. So it has a single stem and then it kind of grows out from the top. And if it is a paniculata hydrangea, being that they bloom on new wood, you should probably still see flowers forming, whether it's later into the summer. You should still be okay. It's more the issue with the old wood hydrangeas, the mop heads, that, you know, if you cut them later in the winter, you won't have flowers. Mm-hmm. So hopefully you still get some this year.
Yeah.
I hope. Okay.
Yeah. We'll keep our fingers crossed for you.
Advice.
Thanks, Jerry.
Right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, and we have Patricia on the line. Hi, Patricia. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I would like to know how and when to propagate my burning bush hedge. I want to replace all of my boxwoods.
Well, I know we have a lot of guests who would be excited to hear you say you want to replace all your boxwoods, because we have a lot of boxwood haters who are panelists on this show. I'm not saying the people we have here, but we have some anti-boxwood people. Carrie, do you have thoughts on propagating this burning bush?
Yeah, so I can definitely relate with your boxwood woes. in terms of, so burning bush is actually, it is a non-native species. It has been deemed invasive by the Ohio Invasive Plant Council, but it's not regulated yet. So because of that, that's why it is still something that is legal to plant or purchase at garden centers. I don't really have any information on propagating it. I would suggest that you consider other alternatives out there besides burning bush. I know that a good alternative is hazelnut. Hazelnut is a native plant, but it'll give you that fall color. And there's some other alternatives as well. But if you're looking specifically for burning bush, I don't have information on propagation of that.
Brandon, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I would agree. Use an alternative. If you do, here's the thing. If you do want to propagate anything that's like a shrub, I tend to have the best luck with softwood cuttings. So when they're putting out that fresh new growth in the spring, you take those cuttings, you dip them in hormone, and you stick them in soil or potting media, and you cover them with a piece of plastic. So you could do it that way. In early summer, you can leave them outside as cuttings, and they'll root pretty well because it's warmer. But also another alternative I really like is chokeberries, because they are native. They have great fall color, and they have berries for the birds, and they're not invasive. And there's one called, I think, Grolo, that's like a foot tall, that is wonderful as a ground cover too.
Oh. Well, I hope that helps, Patricia. Thanks for your call. We have a couple more emails. Let's see. Susan emails, I live in Oakley, and everything seems to be blooming very early this season. Sedums, oak leaf, hydrangeas are covered with buds, which usually doesn't happen until much later in the summer. Are others seeing this too? What are you seeing around here, Brandon? Are you seeing a lot of early blooming?
I feel like we did have a really early warm spring, and then we didn't get a lot of cold damage, so it kind of, nothing was checked back too much by the cold. So, you know, also in an urban area, of course, you know, you're going to see things blooming much earlier than other places because of the heat island effect. So without knowing her exact site, but that's potentially possible. Yeah, she could be seeing things earlier.
Are you seeing a lot of early growth, Kamisha, with all the warm weather we've been having?
More in particular, I'm seeing pests a lot early. Like, I've seen harlequin beetles maybe a month ago. Mm. And typically, that's pretty early. And, you know, we've all been experiencing the season, less harsh winters, and a lot more pest issues during the summer. And it's mostly because of the lack of maybe, you know, drought and harsh winters that we're just seeing pests overwintering, basically. So we are seeing them, you know, a lot earlier. So that can contribute to some of the issues that we're seeing with pests in our gardens.
Okay. Well, we are going to take a quick break. We'll be wrapping up our gardening show in just a moment. If you have a question, now is the time to call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're wrapping up today's gardening show. My guests are Ohio State University Extension Educator Carrie Brown, Kenton County Extension Office Horticulture Extension Agent Brandon George, and Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator Kamisha Montgomery. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for calling. What is your question?
Yes, my common or eastern redbud tree, which is about 15 to 18 years old, only has probably two-thirds to three-quarters of its branches with leaves this year. And I had trimmed it last fall, but there's more branches now that do not have leaves, and I'm wondering what's wrong with it and what I can do to repair it.
Hmm. You have thoughts on that, Brandon?
Yeah, I mean, redbuds are definitely prone to verticillium wilt and other vascular diseases, but I would check around the base of your trunk, look for any lesions, look for any damage, look at the roots, if at all possible. Take a lot of photos, bring in samples, and bring them to your local extension office. Maybe they can help diagnose and come out in person, but they are definitely prone to certain diseases that can kill them. So just keep that in mind, that it might, depending on what it is, it might not be treatable or not. So
That was not very cheerful, Brandon.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Well, thanks, Rebecca. I hope it works out for you. We appreciate your listening.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We have an email from Matt. Matt asks, I have plants along all three sides of my backyard, neglected it for 2 years. 50% is honeysuckle now. How do I get rid of the honeysuckle? Brandon, you have a very despondent look on your face right now.
Yeah, you know, again, that's one of those serious, serious invasives that you're going to have to treat chemically if you really want to take care of the issue. So using a product that contains either glyphosate or triclopyr, those are the active ingredients that will work on woody, brushy plants that are invasive, and making sure you apply at the correct dosage. I would say it's going to be most effective in late summer, fall, when more of the energy is going back into the root system. Applying it now might not be as effective, but make sure you can keep removing them by hand or whacking them back with some kind of tool. But, you know, if you really want to take care of it, use a contact systemic herbicide.
Now, apparently, there was another part of Matt's email. He is concerned about treating chemically and not harming the plants he wants to keep. So killing off the honeysuckle, but preserving the plants that he loves.
Right.
Is that a problem?
No, that's exactly why you want to use systemic herbicide, because you're only going to have it target and spray and touch, make contact with the plants you don't want. And as careful as you can be, make sure you're only applying it, because it's going to feed through that root system. But in theory, you know, it shouldn't affect anything that the systemic herbicide wasn't in contact with. So,
okay. Carrie, do you have any other honeysuckle tricks you can pass along for Matt?
Yeah. So, as he said, a systemic herbicide is your best bet. If you can, use like a cut stump method where you're actually cutting back the bush and painting the stump, then you can really ensure that you're not hitting anything off target. I don't know that I would really start to do that kind of herbicide treatment until maybe midsummer, but you can do that into the fall. A lot of times these invasive plants will have that extended growing season, so they'll still be green while everything else is going dormant, and that's a great time to hit them, because then, you know, the desirable stuff, there's less of a chance for off target. If he's dealing with a Japanese honeysuckle, which is the vining honeysuckle, that can also be challenging. But that's also something that has that extended growing season and allows you to kind of attack it while other things have, you know, already gone to sleep for the winter.
We got an email from Carol. Carol writes, I've been finding more ants in my home recently. They come from outside and increase with the rain. Is there anything I can plant around my house or foundation to discourage ants?
Oh, I really want to take this question. I've been dealing with this so much. I feel like when there's really wet weather, they have to try to escape and they look for dry places. But I can tell you this. It's been said with ants especially, don't plant things around the foundation of your homes, because that can, any root, any like wood material, that's just more harboring of them to live in colonies. So I would say that's the opposite. Keep things away from your home with ants. And use some of those home sprays if you have to, that are like preventative in the first place. That way you're not always dealing with them. So make sure you don't have any like wood or rotting pieces of decaying debris against your home. Make sure it's like sanitary, and hopefully you'll help keep some of the ants away. But all the wet weather is a big reason why they're going in homes.
Okay, let's talk about something more cheerful, strawberries. So, Kamisha, we just got a news release that indicated some strawberry crops are really struggling around here this year. What are you seeing with strawberries?
Well, I was just out in Loveland at Loveland Community Garden and just Saturday, and the strawberries didn't seem to have any issues there. As a matter of fact, we had a garden work day there, and we were munching on some while we were during the middle of the garden work day. But I didn't see really too many issues. I know some people are experiencing some issues due to, you know, the really quick way that the heat came into the climate here. Some people are experiencing some issues as far as that's concerned, amongst other things that would affect.
Yeah. Brandon, what are you seeing with strawberries?
Yeah, I definitely have been seeing a lot of botrytis, gray mold. And I think, again, it has to do with the fact that it was warm and it's been so wet. And so strawberries, if they don't get good air circulation, that's going to have a lot of disease issues breeding in that area. So you can make sure covering your soil with either straw or pine needles or something, keeping them above the ground so they're not directly touching soil. That keeps them a bit drier. So things that you can just promote with air circulation if at all possible. And the more sun they get too, the more they're going to dry off quicker as well.
Yeah. We're coming up on the end of our gardening show. If you've got questions, now's the time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We got an email from Mary. Mary writes, I have a terrible problem with slugs in my raised vegetable beds. Any tips? I'm going to throw that one to you, Kamisha.
Yeah, definitely. As far as slugs, there's a remedy, a homemade remedy, I would say, is just use like a small can similar to the size of maybe like a tuna can and filling it with beer, actually. And the slugs will, you know, digest that and just not have a good time. There's another remedy called Escargot that is a natural pest control for slugs that you can try to purchase and use that in your garden.
Interesting. So you're trying to get slugs drunk? Is that what you're doing with this beer?
Not necessarily intoxicated, but I'm not sure how the chemical reaction works with the beer and the slugs, but it is a remedy that is thought of highly to use as far as slugs are concerned, along with the other one that I mentioned.
Okay. Wow. Okay. We got an email from Holly. I think this is in reference to the ants. Holly writes, use diatomaceous earth around the foundation outside. Is that something that could be helpful, Brandon?
I have heard that too. And of course, you could also poison them, but that's another thing. But yeah, The diatomaceous earth, certainly, I think the material over their bodies does hurt them, and I think it keeps them away too. But I think then you have to reapply, obviously, with rain and stuff. So
yeah, okay.
Yeah, I've heard the diatomaceous earth. I've heard chalk. I've heard cinnamon. I've heard cayenne pepper. So
I've heard the cinnamon thing too.
Yeah. Huh.
Okay, maybe Cincinnati chili that has some of that stuff in there. Let's see. We've got Greg on the line. Hi, Greg. Thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
More of a comment on the honeysuckle.
Okay.
What I did was, I had a honeysuckle problem also, but I got the dragon torch, and I basically burned all the foliage and killed the foliage, and then I would cut it down at the stump, and then I would take the dragon, the fire, and I would just burn the stump too. Mm. Sort of like the painting of the insecticide or the pesticide or whatever. Huh. But I would just burn it all.
Just kind of a flamethrower situation there, huh?
Yeah, and then that way it opens it up for air circulation, and you don't have as much greenage, but you still have the color of the vine laying out there.
Okay, well, thanks, Greg. What do you think about that, Brandon? I always get a little nervous when people are using a lot of fire. I'm just going to say that. Maybe it's my mom genes coming out.
I mean, I think that's great to kill it temporarily. If it has a very, very old, strong root system, it's going to respond by regrowing, you know, because there's enough of it below the surface that the fire flame cannot kill, that it's going to resprout from the roots. Mm. And that's my worry. It's, you know, you have to kill it entirely throughout the root system. And honeysuckle is so vigorous and their roots go very far. And I just would not be confident that that would end the problem.
Okay. We have Amira on the line. Hey, thanks for calling. What is your question or comment?
I have lived in our house for over 35 years, I guess, or close to that. And we moved there. There was a wisteria plant, looked great. And about 5 years ago, it just died. So we replanted it. The new one looked great, and it didn't come back this year. So I wondered if there's something one can do, or do they come back or not?
Hmm. Well, thank you. What do you think, Brandon?
Well, I mean, the Chinese wisteria, Japanese wisteria, or the American wisteria, they're all hardy and they're very, very vigorous perennial vines, woody vines. And without knowing your specific site conditions, I'm not sure what would have caused the first one to die and then the one you replanted to die as well. So again, I would maybe bring in the dead plant to your extension office, do a soil sample, just check out what possibly could be causing it, so it's not something you're doing that, or maybe just trying to figure out and solve the mystery of what's going on there.
Kind of an autopsy, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Would trimming it in the fall affect it or not?
I mean, they're really vigorous, so for it to die completely through the root system, I'm not sure. But I mean, pruning it is fine to a degree. You obviously want to make sure there's enough that it can reflower each year, but I don't know what would have killed it entirely without knowing the site situation.
Yeah, I don't either. Okay. Well, I just was really more curious if they would come back, but I'm not so sure that's going to happen.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening. We hope they come back for you. And let's see, we have Kay on the line. Hi, Kay. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi. I have a question about two invasive plants. One is a vine, and I have looked it up online to try to find the name of it, because once I did know the name of it, it's a type of ivy. It's not English ivy. It has very, very thin, very hard vine, the stem. It grows up trees. It grows up walls. It grows up plants. It has grown over my English ivy, and I want to get rid of it. Eventually, I'd like to get rid of my English ivy, too, but at this point, I don't want to kill everything that's around it. Plus, it's in among rhododendrons and azaleas and hostas, and I just want to know the best way to get rid of it. And if you might know what it looks like, it's a flat leaf. It has, I think, like 5 points. I'm sorry I'm not home right now to actually describe it well to you. I was just out and about and heard your program, so I thought I'd call.
Okay. Well, thanks, Kay. Carrie, you have any thoughts about this mystery vine?
I am not sure. English ivy was the first thing that came to mind, but she said that that's not it. I'm not sure what this is.
Brandon, is there other ivy around here that can be annoying like that?
Well, it sounds like it's not winter creeper based on what she described the leaf. I was going to ask her if it's evergreen or not. Parthenocissus winter creeper is a vine that does climb around here. It's native. It can climb over things. But without knowing the leaf or if it's deciduous or not, I'm trying to narrow it down, but I'm not exactly sure.
Okay. Kay says
take
it's...
Take a picture.
Oh, I'm sorry, Kay.
Go to that site that identifies with things, you know, with pictures online.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's quite annoying because it's just overtaking everything very quickly.
Yeah. Well, Kay, good luck. I hope you get your mystery solved. We appreciate your calling and we appreciate you listening to the show. Okay, we've got one more caller. Hi, Jackie. Thanks for calling. What's your question or comment? Quickly.
Oh, yeah, real quickly. Thank you, Tim, for taking my call. This is going to be my first year of putting in a small organic raised bed vegetable garden. And, however, we have an infestation of the what they call the Lazarus lizards everywhere. And so I'm wondering, do I need to do something, again, non-toxic to stop those, or are they going to have, you know, will they eat my seeds, et cetera? So how do I manage the Lazarus lizards in an organic garden is my question.
Kamisha, you have thoughts on that?
Well, there's really not too much you can do as far as those lizards are concerned, but I also, you know, you will be successful. You know, just have to think about what I call the 70-30 rule. You are going to get 70 and 30% is going to go back to the food web. So just consider it to be something like that. But you can always, like I said at the top of the show, is just think about some kind of barrier or structure to put around your raised bed, because there might be eventually more pests that you'll have to deal with that can help defeat.
Do those lizards hurt anything?
Not necessarily. I mean, okay. They might eat a little bit of the foliage.
Okay. Well, hope that helps, Jackie. Thanks for calling. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. And I should have said, I've been talking with my wonderful guests from Ohio State University, Extension Educator Carrie Brown, Kenton County Extension Office Horticulture Extension Agent Brandon George, and Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator Kamisha Montgomery. Thank you all so much for your time today. You've been fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you.
And this is Lucy May. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition.